What is happening, y'all? This is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today, I am interviewing Karis Rea. Karis is a producer at the Epoch Times and a fellow with the Jewish Leadership Project. She also works with the Middle East Forum and Based Records. A former life found her touring the world as a drummer and songwriter before becoming disillusioned with the political and cultural arrogance of the music industry. But listen to how great her music is for a second. Absurdist flash fiction. In this episode, we talk BLM's history of anti-Semitism, Soviet Union influence on Black nationalist movements, and modern-day anti-Zionism. Spicy topics that will inform or inspire you to do your own research, because remember, there is no such thing as a Black perspective, just Black people with perspectives.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.
Karis, thank you so much for joining me here today on the Free Black Thought Podcast. I know this is going to be, I hope the listeners have heavy load, because we're going to do a lot of unpacking in this episode. That's what I feel is coming. We've got a lot of great topics that I'm going to learn a lot too during this episode, talking about the connection between BLM and anti-Semitism, Soviet Union influence, and the Black nationalist movements that we've seen throughout history. I'm really excited for this episode. But before we get into that stuff, per usual, we just need you to tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? How did you get to where you are today?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me, Connie. I myself am a big fan of Free Black Thought, especially your Twitter account, which I follow on a regular basis. My name's Karis, as you mentioned. I am originally from the Bay Area, California. I spent my childhood and my adolescence there. And when I turned 18, I moved to New York City. I went to New York University and received a bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism, as well as religious studies. I then pushed a kind of more lucrative career aside to focus on the arts. I'm a musician. And I pursued music for, I think, about 7 years after college.
What kind of music?
A drummer, or in another life, I was a drummer, and I was very active in the Brooklyn indie music scene, right? The hipster scene, if you will. And I toured and recorded and performed in dozens of bands. And I had my own project as well. I really love songwriting. I'm not that great of a singer, but I do write songs. So I had my own project for about 5 years called Pep. We recorded a few albums and toured as well. And then I kind of pivoted. I think I probably got sick of hustling, to be honest. And also I was pretty disillusioned by the industry. I didn't like the political and cultural arrogance of it, especially being a proud Zionist and at that point politically independent. You know, these days I call myself a conservative, but it took me a while to accept that label, having grown up in a very having lived basically in the two most progressive areas in the country.
Was your family progressive? Like, was that how you were raised in your own home?
No, my parents were more classic 60s liberal, never radical or super progressive, but they underwent the same changes that I did around the same time. I mean, they were always very pro-Israel. And I think that was the opening for us to begin to explore and question our political views in other ways as well, as we saw the left become increasingly anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic. You know, it made us look into other issues and because we felt more aligned with conservatives on this particular issue, and then, you know, other issues as well, as we kind of watch society morph a little bit in terms of general politics. So I got tired of the industry, but I still had my kind of one foot in the door. And at the same time, I went to grad school in Israel. I got a master's degree in counterterrorism and homeland security, which seems it seems kind of sexy, but it was kind of a useless degree, to be honest. And so, yeah, I lived in Israel for a year while I did that. And I came back. I had trouble getting a job in that industry. And I had already become pretty active in nonprofit organizations that dealt with fighting anti-Semitism and also advocating for Israel. So I stayed in that industry, mostly working from home. I worked for a number of different nonprofits, such as CAMRA, Jewish National Fund. I think that's where I started as an intern, but I worked for CAMRA, Middle East Forum, who I still do work for, the Gatestone Institute. There are some others as well. And then I think it was during the pandemic. Yes, I was working for CCFP, Creative Community for Peace, which is a nonprofit that fights the boycott movement, the mm-hmm. BDS movement against Israel in Hollywood and the entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. So I was working for CCFP and, you know, still working from home. And as I was watching what seemed like our society falling apart, you know, everything from the pandemic to, you know, the restrictions and then the 2020 riots and all that kind of stuff, I became, you know, much more interested in other topics and really wanted to stop working from home, even though a lot of people had just started working from home at that yeah. point. That had actually been my reality for a long time. And so I decided to utilize my original degree in journalism, broadcast journalism, and I started working in broadcast again. I went to Newsmax for a short period of time, and now I'm at Epoch Times as a producer. So I produce a couple shows there. I'm still active in, you know, Jewish and Israel advocacy with an organization called the Jewish Leadership Project, as well as helping out the Middle East Forum. And also, miraculously, I'm back into the music world a little bit. I help out this new anti-woke record label called Based Records.
That's so perfect.
released a few singles, and that's really, really fun. So I wear a lot of hats, but I would say that at my core, especially after October 7th, I feel like the most important thing to me and my values are, you know, not even Judaism as a religion, but just Judaism in terms of an identity, a peoplehood, and a history.
Can you share with us a little bit about your personal kind of like faith background? What do you Sure. spiritually practice? What's culture to you versus religion and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm largely secular. You know, I grew up celebrating the high holidays, and I went to Hebrew school until third grade and then went to public school. But other than that, you know, religion really didn't play a role in my life. I'm agnostic and continue to be agnostic. And yet I feel incredibly close to my Jewish identity, perhaps because my grandparents were, they both passed on, but they were Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. And that event was very significant in my life growing up. You know, my father obviously, you know, was very affected by that growing up in a household like that. And so I was always very aware of that history. And we spoke about it a lot and watched a lot of movies about it and read books. And so that might be one reason why Judaism has been, you know, important to me from the get-go. But it's becoming increasingly important to me as the years have gone on. And even now I'm even thinking to myself, you know, I want to go back and study the Torah because I never really felt like I was listening during Hebrew school. Yeah. I want to go do, you know, so, you know, in a way, just to be completely vulnerable, sometimes I feel like this fraud or this imposter talking about Jewish issues, Jewish advocacy, anti-Semitism, Israel, because I myself, you know, don't really have a strong religious background, you know, in understanding a lot of biblical history, but I would like to, you know, be, you know, have more of that foundation going forward.
Are you seeing, like, in your circles, assuming that you have lots of Jewish friends and family that may or may not have been secular before October 7th or in recent years? Do you see kind of a lot of people sort of going back and saying, wait a minute, kind of almost maybe feeling, I'm not saying that you're suddenly like, I believe in God, I'm going to become an Orthodox Jew, but that people are starting to like open their Bibles up more and like explore, like really want to get in touch with the religious side of their Jewish roots.
That could be what's happening. I have not seen that. What I have seen is that my friends and acquaintances who are liberal or largely secular have now much more embraced their Jewish identity, just in terms of being a proud Jew, right? I think kind of in the same way that I discussed it about just, you know, being part of a people, a Jewish people, right? Because I think one of the major misconceptions in society, especially in the West, is that Judaism is just a religion. But we can see that, you know, just by virtue of the fact that we have our own language, right? Just something as simple as that. That's just not the case. We are a mm-hmm. culture. We are a people. We are a nation, right? With our own traditions and you know, history. And so I think that people since October 7th that largely kept that identity to the side or in the background are now much more proud, while at the same time maybe being more fearful or scared as they see you know, what they consider an emergence of anti-Semitism. I think they just feel connected more to their history and their identity as a Jewish person.
In the kind of pro-Israel Zionist space, nonprofit space, is it, this could be confusing to people because I'm a Christian and I've been a part of and applied to be a part of different Christian groups and organizations. And usually you have to make a proclamation of faith as part of that in order to be. They want a letter from your pastor. They want to know that you're legit, right? But there's a lot of secular Jews that are in, you know, doing this pro-Israel work. And so I'm just wondering, like, are some nonprofits more like, okay, you really need to be a believer? Others are secular. Or is it always just, hey, we're all Jews, however you practice is your own business. We're all in this together. I think like for a lot of like the Christian mind, the Western Christian mind that doesn't know, maybe a lot of people haven't even been exposed to Jewish folks, depending on where they live. It's hard to understand that dynamic.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that the religious nonprofits carry that element, right? Of probably there's not secular Jews in organizations that deal specifically with the religious aspects of Judaism, but I was never part of those organizations. So while there were always Jews in the organizations that I worked with that were, you know, either Orthodox or conservative or just, you know, believers in a Jewish God, there was never any sort of, you know, requirement or purity test. And I think that really just goes to show that Judaism is not just a religion, right? Because if everybody is seen as a Jew in these organizations, regardless of whether they even believe in a Jewish God, then there has to be something more to it than just a religious faith.
Right. And when you're dealing with anti-Semitism, the person attacking you isn't going to be like, hey, do you believe? Because if you don't, I'll leave you alone. No, they consider you a problem whether you believe or not.
Absolutely.
Right?
So, yeah, they don't discriminate.
Right. So now within there's all kinds of folks out there that are in the pro-Israel space, and different people have different areas of expertise, I guess, within anti-Semitism. So, you know, we had David Bernstein on, and he was the one kind of blaring the horn on woke progressive anti-Semitism before, and a lot of people were kind of telling him to shut up before now. So that was kind of his niche area. We're going to talk about the relationship, the Black Jewish relationship, because this is Free Black Thought. Has that always been like kind of one of your niche areas that you've been interested in, or what other areas of anti-Semitism, if any, do you also consider yourself to, that's kind of like a pet project or a pet interest of yours?
No, it's just something I've learned about as we've seen an increase in anti-Semitism from the Black community, right? And understanding that the historic relationship, at least during the civil rights movement, between Blacks and Jews was so tight and so close, you know, it's really, it's just been alarming to watch, you know, these overwhelming number of attacks committed mostly by Black Americans in throughout New York City, you know, on visibly Orthodox Jews. So I guess just in watching anti-Semitism come from the Black community, you know, it's just, you just end up learning about, you know, why that's happening and how that happened. But I started at the Jewish National Fund, which is more about the preservation of, you know, Zionism in Israel. And then I really moved to focus on combating anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in the media. So that was a niche of mine. I also,
and I'd say that's connected to the Black, I mean, to Black anti-Semitism. The media plays such a key role in that, because there's a lot of famous Black people that don't seem to be too keen on them Jews.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they're a big, you know, they have a big platform via the media. I mean,
tens of millions of followers, which are more than there are Jews in the world. You know, when Kanye was doing all his, all his, like, you know, Jew hating, going on all his Jew hating rampages, and he was tweeting them out. I mean, he was tweeting, you know, one tweet would go reach potentially more people than there are Jews in the entire world.
I've never thought absolutely. About that. That's such a good point. Wow.
Yeah. The reach together of like these celebrities who spew hatred is it's very concerning. But yeah, so that was definitely a focus of mine. And then, you know, it just depended whatever nonprofit I was working with, you know, that became my niche. So when I was working with Middle East Forum, who I still, you know, help out part-time, I've always been part-time with them. They're focused on the problem of Islamic extremism, specifically in the West. So that's definitely another niche of mine I've been involved in, and just issues surrounding radical Islam and terrorism and the like. And then Gatestone Institute, I was just with them for a little bit, helping out with their social media. And they're just an incredible media outlet that publishes really compelling pieces, often focused on, you know, Israel and Middle Eastern affairs. And then finally, the last nonprofit I was with before I switched out of that industry was CCFP, as I mentioned, which was fighting the BDS movement in the entertainment industry. Right. So I was very concerned with what you were just talking about, which was, you know, celebrity anti-Semitism and the influence that was having on society.
You know, you talked about Jews and Blacks used to be very tight several decades ago. And now, you know, there's a lot of anti-Semitism within the Black community in America. Has that been a slow drip, or does an organization like BLM play like a big catalyst role, or was something like BLM more of like the straw that broke the camel's back, and then we just saw this explosion, you know, break through the dam? How did it disappear over the decades? I'm not saying it's not totally gone. Obviously, there's still plenty of people who have those relationships. But why do we see this trend happening? What was the catalyst?
Yeah, I do think it was a slow drip. And I was actually reading an article today, and they were talking about the October 7th and the intelligence failure that led to that and the false assumptions. And they quoted somebody, and I don't remember who it was, in the article. And they said, that person said that, you know, everything leading up to this happened gradually and then suddenly. And that's kind of how I think I would answer your question. I think what we're seeing in terms of rising anti-Semitism in the Black community is the result of decades-long preaching and influence by Black nationalist groups such as the Nation of Islam or the Black Panthers, the Black Hebrew Israelites, that really kind of started to have substantial influence in the 70s. And now that all those people are adults who were kind of influenced by that ideology from a young age, those adults are now kind of carrying out these ideologies that they were raised with. I definitely think that BLM was an inflection point for sure. One of the things that not a lot of people talk about is that during the riots, BLM specifically targeted Jewish communities, specifically in LA. Daniel Greenfield wrote about this in Front Page magazine, I believe. I think he called it the LA pogrom. And Black Lives Matter specifically went to, you know, Jewish synagogues and community centers. And people didn't really talk about that in the media. And for those of us who had been following Black Lives Matter since before that, really since about 2015, it made perfect sense, because unlike what I think the mainstream believes, that Black Lives Matter is the, you know, the continuation of the civil rights movement. You know, I'm sure a lot of your Black audience is aware of this, but probably not so much, white viewers. You know, I think it's important to understand that MLK's vision for civil rights is not BLM's vision, right? There was kind of like a fissure, right? After MLK and Dumasani, Washington talks, a lot about this, where, you know, the vision of nonviolent and interracial equality and colorblindness was basically co-opted in a lot of ways by Black nationalists, Black power, Black supremacist movements, led by people like Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad and Louis Farrakhan, who's, you know, in my opinion, probably the most dangerous anti-Semite in America. And these people were opposed to MLK's vision. They did not believe in colorblindness. They did not believe in nonviolence. You know, they did not believe in judging people by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. These people believed in, there's a reason why they're called the Black Power Movement, right? They believed in power and they believed in things like reparations and making people pay who had wronged them and, you know, rewriting their history and, achieving a sort of status in society where they could then, you know, right the wrongs by putting down others, in a way. And I think this was very, very much influenced by the Soviet Union, you know, and Marxist ideology, that definitely was not, you know, nonviolent and was revolutionary in nature. And that's where BLM comes from. BLM is a continuation of the Black nationalist movement. And, you know, they're clear about that. If you listen to their demands and, you know, you read their original, the original Movement for Black Lives statement and their goals and stuff, like, these are not the goals of, you know, of Bayard Rustin and Philip Randolph, you know, and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Like, these are the goals of, you know, the student of SNCC, right? Of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who originally, I think, you know, did really wonderful things for the civil rights movement with sit-ins and, you know, their freedom rides and everything. But they, increasingly changed gears. And by the end of the 70s, they, you know, were singing a very, very different tune. And so, you know, I just don't think that people understand that, like, any sort of, people don't realize that just because a movement advocates for the Black community does not mean that it's a civil rights movement, and that, you know, and the same could be said about any other minority, you know, any other movements representing a minority.
Right. So what's your theory as to, I mean, MLK, just as an example, my grandfather, before we had an MLK day, he took up MLK day personally. Like, he decided, we're not working on his birthday and we're going to have an MLK day as a family. And I think a lot of Black people did this. And, you know, people will talk about how you'd go into the home of a Black family and there'd be a Bible and then a picture of MLK right next to it, or a picture of Jesus and a picture of MLK. Like, those were the two, like, heroes, you know, for a lot of Black families. And I ask myself this question too, when it comes to, you know, it seems like Black people, a lot of Black folks aren't familiar with the history. They've forgotten the history. They haven't been taught the history or something in terms of forgetting, like, who actually enslaved us. It wasn't Republicans. It was Democrats. Mm-hmm. I wonder the same thing with MLK. Like, how is it that people forgot who used to be the number one hero to Black families across America, forgot that, you know, he wanted everyone not to be judged by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. He was basically an early adopter of racelessness in a sense, mm-hmm. not that he thought that you should never mention that you're Black or that there's not a Black culture or anything like that. But in terms of how we approach others, he was pretty raceless in that regards. And is it just that once you get told, if you're just told something enough times, you start to believe it? Is that what happened? You're told enough times that Republicans are dirty racists, you believe it. You're told enough times that, you know, the Jews are bad for Black people, you start to believe it. Is that what's happened, or is there something
else? That's a good question. I'd say it's probably a case of, you know, who screams the loudest, right? I mean, MLK was center stage, and then these other groups kind of took center stage because, you know, they were loud and they were rioting and they were, you know, and then they got coverage, media coverage, and so maybe it's not so much that people forgot. I think maybe people are just kind of, you know, following the groups and the individuals that had, you know, a cultural impact, right, in history. And I think that probably these figures like Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, I think they probably just eclipsed largely the MLK movement, which I imagine was continuing. I mean, it continues to this day. We have so many incredible Black leaders that, you know, are living his legacy. But I think that they were largely eclipsed by these voices. And I think there was a lot of support behind them. I mean, like I said, the Soviet Union was heavily funding groups and I think that the media was largely becoming sympathetic to radical left-wing movements. Yeah, so I think that they probably just had support and that's how people know them, because they're the people we learn about in our textbooks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk about dive a little deeper into the Soviet Union influence? Because it's kind of two pronged in a sense, because Soviet Union has their hands in the way that even why we use the term Palestine today, you know, how we use the term Palestinians to describe people. They're kind of like they're involved in this two front battle. People might hear Soviet Union and Black nationalist movements, like, what do they even have to gain from that? Like, why would they fund, you know, can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So something that people might not be aware of is that the Soviet Union was actually the first entity that voted to recognize the Jewish nation when it was reestablished in 1948. And the reason was because the Soviet Union was hoping and expecting Israel to ally with it against the U.S. in the Cold War, right? Because when Israel was reestablished, this was right after World War II, and the Cold War had commenced, right? And we had these two superpowers that came out of the war victorious, and they were fighting each other, and they were trying to establish spheres of influence. And Israel was a very important, that was, you know, going to be a beacon in the Middle East, a front, right, for either the Soviet Union or the U.S. And there's a lot of socialist elements in early Israeli society, and Jews, you know, have largely been liberal in relation to, you know, other monotheistic religions. So I think there was an expectation that Israel would ally with the Soviet Union, but it did not. And you can imagine from both a symbolic and a practical perspective, this was a massive blow to the Russians. I mean, they ended up, as a result, arming and allying with all of Israel's enemies, the Arab nations, its Arab neighbors. And they began a massive delegitimization campaign against the state of Israel.
Why is this tiny sliver of a country, why is that a massive blow? If they, you know, why can't a Soviet Union say, well, that sucks. We misjudged that one, and just keep pushing. Why do they have to focus all their manipulation guns, I'll use it metaphorically, on Israel, because Israel didn't become their ally?
Well, I think because at that time, Israel was, you know, the creation of Israel was a very pivotal moment through, you know, globally. It wasn't just an important moment for the Jews. People, you know, besides, you know, its Arab neighbors and perhaps, you know, residual, you know, Nazi supporters or extremist Christians, largely the world was sympathetic to the Jews. This was right after the Holocaust. And they saw the reestablishment of Israel as an incredible exercise in triumph over colonialism, right? I mean, here were these people that had their ancient nation and capital of Jerusalem in this region, right? Only to be exiled again and again, even though there was always a presence, you know, a larger or smaller presence, depending on the time. But despite being continually conquered by these invading entities, whether it was the Babylonians or the Assyrians or the Crusaders or the Romans or the Ottomans, Jews always came back, right? Only to finally break free of the chains of colonialism and reestablish sovereignty in their indigenous and ancestral homeland. Generally speaking, everybody kind of understood this, that that's what this was. And so it was a very special moment. And so, you know, I'm sure the Soviet Union understood this as well. And and there was probably other very practical reasons why this was important. You know, I don't think I'm particularly qualified to get into the details, but I'm sure there were, you know, economic reasons, you know, maybe economic, trade, right? Other political aspects of this, you know. But definitely from a symbolic perspective, it was a pivotal event in history. So the Soviet Union did what they did best. They began a propaganda campaign. I mean, look, this wasn't the only one. This is the one that I know about, right? I mean, the Soviet Union had massive propaganda campaigns going for all sorts of for all sorts of causes that they were trying to promote. And this was a big one of theirs. And they basically created this idea of anti-Zionism. They appropriated Nazi imagery and messaging. And when I say appropriate, I literally mean appropriate, not, you know, abstractly. They went into Nazi archives and they took out the same posters and the same messaging campaigns, you know, like even famous ones that a lot of us know about, like, you know, the Jew octopus with its tentacles out, and, you know, the Jew is the rat or whatever. And they just, you know, they replaced the copy with, you know, they changed it to Russian, and they replaced the word Jew with Zionist, because that's what Israel was, right? Israel was the culmination of the Zionist aspiration, right? Zionism is just some people say it's the civil rights movement of the Jews. It's a very simple concept. It has nothing to do with Palestinians. It's a movement. It's a national liberation movement for Jews to have a state in their ancestral homeland. No more, no less. At least political Zionism, because there's different forms of Zionism. So Israel was the realization of this dream, of this movement, which had been very, very active since around the mid 1800s. And so the Soviet Union knew that, they understood, especially I think they saw what an incredible force anti-Semitism was, but it was now very unpopular. So in order to fight this front, this Middle Eastern front, they had to delegitimize Israel as a state, and they began a massive campaign, and they tailored this campaign. I mean, it's so, there are books written about this. There's a wonderful, wonderful researcher, Isabella Tiberovsky, I'm not sure, but she specializes in this. She specializes in Soviet Union anti-Zionism. And, you know, and there's records of all of this, right? I mean, this is, none of this is conjecture. The documentation of this is vast. And, you know, everything from, you know, and we're talking about millions and millions of pamphlets, brochures, films, books, articles, you know, you name it, were distributed against Israel by the Soviet Union throughout the world in every place that they were trying to influence, to you know, to expand their ideology. And they tailored this campaign specifically to different parts of the world and to movements. So they started the whole idea that Israel is an apartheid state in South Africa, right? Because they went to Africa and they knew that that was a very important, you know, that was, you know, a very emotional subject matter and very relevant. And so they were like, oh, well, Israel's doing the same thing to the Palestinians that white people did to Black Africans. So, you know, they tailored, and then they went to various movements in the U.S., academic movements, activist groups, you know, political movements. And they went to these Black power groups, which were, you know, just starting to emerge. I mean, really, this Soviet Union campaign started as early as the 50s, but it didn't really take off, and they didn't throw as much resources into it, until the Six-Day War, post-1967. That's when things really changed. That's when the world stopped being kind of universally supportive of the state of Israel. And that's also when, you know, when a lot of these groups, these Black nationalist groups were emerging. And, you know, many of them had, you know, were aligned already ideologically with the Soviet Union. And, but if not, I mean, the Soviet Union was there to guide them. And the Soviet Union took many of these leaders, they brought them there, and they trained them in, you know, in Marxist ideology. And fundamental to that ideology, a fundamental component of it was anti-Zionism. So all of these Marxist groups, Black or not, but, you know, we're talking about Black groups specifically, you know, they, anti-Zionism was an important component of the ideology. And not a lot of people know that. And that was very much, you know, almost exclusively the influence of the Soviet Union. I mean, and the Soviet Union got into academia. I mean, the influence that the Soviet Union had on academia, it cannot be understated. We're seeing the effects of that, of all of that today. And there was a very famous 1975 UN resolution that it's essentially called the Zionism is Racism resolution, and that's what it was. And the Soviet Union, they wrote this resolution, they pushed this resolution. This was a Soviet Union-led initiative in the United Nations. Now, thankfully, that resolution was revoked in you know, right after the Soviet Union broke up. But that was a huge triumph for Russia as well to push that through. That gave the anti-Zionism movement a level of international legitimacy that it didn't have before. So yeah, I mean, people like, you know, Angela Davis and countless others, you know, went to the Soviet Union and trained in this. They were indoctrinated. And it's just really a shame, because MLK's followers saw this happening. And in response, they started, I believe in the 70s, the late 70s, they started their own group. I believe it was Bayard Rustin and Philip Randolph, I want to say, who started BASIC, which was a nonprofit organization to support the state of Israel, specifically to support Israel. Mm-hmm. Because these civil rights leaders understood that their fight, you know, for civil rights was not too different from the fight that the Jews, you know, that the Jews were taking up as well in their indigenous homeland. And they were very disturbed by these breakoff groups. This stuff, you know, there's so much more to this. I'm, I'm really only familiar with the basic history of it. But what I can just, you know, conclude with about that is the influence of the Soviet Union on the modern anti-Zionist movement, particularly within Black national groups, is substantial. And that is why, that is the reason that Black Lives Matter is anti-Israel today, is because its founders were, you know, self-avowed Marxists, trained Marxists, and within that Marxist ideology is an anti-Zionist component.
What is Russia's involvement today with spreading propaganda? Did they just kind of plant the seeds and now they're just reaping the fruit?
I mean, there's definitely anti-Semitism in Russia, for sure. But, you know, a lot of Jews fled Russia in the 1900s, specifically because of that. Before Israel was established, there was two waves of what we call Aliyah, you know, migration to Israel by Russian Jews, who were many of whom were fleeing persecution because anti-Semitism was very normalized in Russian society. But in terms of this messaging campaign, this really subsided after the breakup of the Soviet Union. So the anti-Zionism propaganda campaign largely subsided. I mean, it did. It ended by the time the Soviet Union was over. I that's not to say that there aren't, you know, anti-Zionists in the Soviet, right, in Russia, or people still spreading that propaganda, but there was no infrastructure, you know, after the Soviet Union. It was a completely different,
right,
you know, political entity. But it subsided to the point where even Pravda magazine, which was, you know, the widely recognized propaganda outlet, you know, state outlet of the Soviet Union, Pravda magazine even apologized for its appalling anti-Semitism, which goes to show just how widespread that was.
And you've talked about the different types of Zionism, and I want to talk, and we're talking about modern day anti-Zionism, but can you break down the different types of Zionism? Because even for me, like, I consider myself a Zionist in the sense that I feel like I'm very pro Israel's right to exist. Like, I think there should be a Jewish state and everything that goes with that, the right to self-defense, a duty, you know, I want Israel to destroy him. Like, I want a Hamas obliterated, wiped off the planet. You know, I'm right there. At the same time, I have reservations about, you know, how much money should America send to Israel? Like, they're their own country, you know, like, let them handle their business. And because, you know, I will call out anti-Semitism and I am, you know, like I said, I consider myself a Zionist. People just automatically assume that I think that America should be giving like millions and millions and millions of dollars to Israel, but that's not necessarily my flavor of Zionism. I know it is for other folks. Can you break down the different types of Zionism and then tie that in with what we're seeing as modern day anti-Zionism?
Well, for our purposes, we're really only talking about political Zionism, you know, because political Zionism deals with the aspirations of having a political entity, right? A nation state. There is religious Zionism, there is cultural Zionism, and these are all different movements at various times. And even within each of those movements, there was differing approaches. Even within political Zionism, there was a question of, you know, there was certain Zionist leaders who thought that perhaps, you know, the state, the first state shouldn't be Israel, right? Perhaps there should be a homeland for first somewhere else, you know, before Jews could migrate to Israel. Because I'm not that schooled in other Zionist thinkers, but I can just tell you that within political Zionism, religious Zionism, cultural Zionism, there are differing opinions. But political Zionism is having political aspirations for the Jewish people based on the yearnings that Jews have had for thousands of years to return, right? Jews pray to Jerusalem. Many of our high holidays deal with the, you know, the longing to return to Jerusalem. You know, but I think what you're saying about people automatically assuming that you support throwing lots of aid to Israel just because you say you're a Zionist, that's just a reflection of their own ignorance. I think the conversation about, you know, whether Israel should be receiving aid from the U.S. and how much aid it should receive is such an important conversation that needs to be had. But I think that it needs to be had in good faith, right? So if people are lumping in Israel with Ukraine because they just don't know enough to actually refer to you know, two distinct situations that are very different. And, you know, they're just, you know, kind of the new, this new neo-isolationist movement that naively believes that America can just pull out all of its money everywhere, pull itself up, and somehow the bad actors in the world won't eventually come for us. You know, that's not really a good faith conversation if they're just you know, approaching the issue of aid to Israel in a way where it's like an all or nothing kind of, you know, very superficial subject. But I'm actually one of those people who believes there's some wonderful, wonderful writers in Tablet Magazine who also share my views, Liel Leibovitz and Jacob Segal. And there's a wonderful intellectual named Yoram Ettinger in Israel, who's really been beating this drum for decades, that actually Israel's aid, America's aid to Israel has in many ways actually made Israel weaker and not stronger. I think that eventually Israel should wean itself off of America's aid, but I do not believe that that can be like a hard full stop, because Israel needs to be able to procure its own, you know, defensive weaponry on its soil. Like, it used to manufacture, you know, a lot of its own, you know, defense infrastructure in Israel, and now all of that is happening here in America. And that's really not good for the state, even just for morale, like, you know,
right.
But that's really not good for the state's security. So I think it's really important that over time, like, you know, we actually decouple in that way from each other. But that doesn't mean that we can't have, you know, memorandums of understanding, or that we, you know, or partnerships, right? I do think one of the misconceptions about aid to Israel, and this is kind of one of the reasons, you know, that people don't really, they're not really speaking from a place of knowledge, is that they don't really understand the term aid and what that means. You know, something that maybe your audience would know is that I think something like 70%, maybe even more, of the money that America gives to Israel must be spent in the U.S. So what that means is that because of this aid to Israel is actually employing tens of thousands of people in America with jobs, especially in places like in cities like Boston, which are very grateful for this aid because of this reason. So there's contingencies that make it so that America is actually benefiting in ways that people don't understand from this. It's not just like a blank check. You know, there's many stipulations that go with it. And another one is the fact that, you know, America is privileged to then receive incredibly valuable intelligence from Israel, and that allows it to foil terrorist attacks that we don't know about. I mean, we have no idea. I don't know the amount of attacks that are foiled on its soil. But, you know, like I said at the beginning, I got my degree in counterterrorism. And one thing for sure is that there are attempted attacks on our soil on a regular basis where the perpetrators are caught, and much of this is because of the incredible intelligence sharing that we enjoy with the state of Israel.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's a home base if and when there are military operations in that corner of the world, which there were there still are, even despite the Afghanistan withdrawal. When you have Israel right there as a place to refit and send injured soldiers, like there's all kinds of reasons to have a partner like that in that region. And the intelligence is just one piece of that.
Yeah. And I think that reminds me of another thing, which is that America might you know, give an exorbitant amount of money to Israel. But we are actually saving money when it comes to Israel versus other countries, because we don't fight Israel's wars for them. We don't have troops. We don't have any troops there. I mean, how many countries in Europe and in the Middle East, right? You know, is there an American presence, military presence, right? That takes up enormous resources, right? But we don't fight Israel's battles for them. We don't have any troops there. And I think this is one reason why people say that Israel is kind of fighting the West's battles, right? Because Israel's enemies are not solely against Israel, right? They've made it clear, Islamic Jihad and Hezbollah, they have made it clear again and again and again that they are not looking to stop at Israel, because this really isn't about Israel so much as it is about an intolerance of a non-Muslim presence in that land, right? And eventually, and these are eliminationist groups that are interested in establishing an Islamic caliphate. And that is why they have said that they will not stop at Israel. They will come for the West. So, you know, when Tucker Carlson criticizes Nikki Haley for fear-mongering, because she says, you know, this is not just Israel's war, this is our war. And then, you know, she's criticized for being like a war hawk. Like, perhaps she could have worded that differently. And I understand where Tucker's coming from, but he doesn't understand that we are entwined in this, because Israel's enemies have made it clear that they want to take down the West, mm-hmm. that they are not just against a Jewish presence in the land, they are against Western culture, Western decadence, right? Western values, mm-hmm. religious freedom. So, you know, I think that in a way, Israel is kind of fighting our battle for us that we don't have to fight.
You've just given some great reasons to be, at least have a, like you say, good faith conversations about Israel and what our relationship should be and what kind of aid we should give and what position it has in the world on so many different levels, spiritually, politically, etc. This might be sound silly to say, but like other than all of those reasons that are kind of human reasons to support Israel, or at least, you know, have those good faith conversations, is there a different reasoning behind why Black Americans should, when, you know, when you talk, I guess I should, I'll rephrase it. When you're fighting Black anti-Semitism, is your hope that Black people will just kind of leave the Jews alone, you know, just stop attacking, stop, you know, slandering us, just leave us alone? Or is your goal to actually be like, no, let's join hand in hand, and here's why you specifically as Black Americans should join with us, the Jews, in this cause?
I think the latter would certainly be ideal, but that's not really the goal. I think that I'm gracious for, you know, I think Jews are incredibly gracious for any allies, right? Anybody working with them, whether it's an evangelical Christian, a member of the Black community, whatever. But one of the problems with the Jewish community is that Jews have been in America, Jews have been so reliant on allies and so desperate for allies that we have turned a blind eye to the hatred in some of these communities. And we have excused anti-Semitism when we see it, because we do not want to rock the boat, and we don't want to, you know, have to break ties with other marginalized groups. I don't think that has ever been a winning strategy, ever. You know, and I don't know. And I also, you know, I don't expect anybody to, you know, I mean, everybody has their own interests, individuals and groups, and that's what makes the world go round. That's a beautiful thing. You know, I mean, I know everybody likes to place their cause in the front and center of everything. I mean, at at Epoch, you know, we shoot at least 3 interviews a week, and almost everybody that we interview has some sort of cause that they are fighting for. And they tell us why that cause is the most important cause in the world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But not mm-hmm. every cause can be the most important cause in the world, because then no cause mm-hmm. is important. Yeah, I think it's important not to expect anybody to automatically be fighting with the same, you know, passion and fervor against the anti-Semites that the Jews are. We obviously need help. We obviously, you know, welcome any support. But I think if we don't expect it, then it will be a more genuine and fruitful relationship when we do have it.
Yeah.
I think we need to be humble. And I just think as long as the Black community understands the simple truth that Jews are not their enemy, and that we are, you know, we have faced similar persecution, and you know, Israel is a beacon of hope and light, and the Black community in Israel is treated better than in any of the Arab states, including the Palestinian territories. You know, these are just facts that I would like the Black community to understand. But you know, in terms of you know, lighting a torch with us, you know, I mean, I don't think that it's fair to have that type of expectations, you know, especially when you know, everyone's got their hands full with stuff right now.
Right. And I appreciate that. That's a really honest, fair response. But it reminded me of something I want to ask you about. So speaking of Tucker comments that are made, I made a response podcast. This was, I guess, a couple of weeks ago now. My commentary. It was behind the paywall, so not as many people listen to it. But it was responding to the beef between Candace Owens and Ben Shapiro. And Candace Owens, in my mind, I was Ben Shapiro. That's team Ben Shapiro on this. And but one of the points that Candace made, I think, on her own show, but then also when she went and was on Tucker's show, was that she talked about why are so many Jewish people just now pulling their money from Harvard? Like, this woke stuff's been a problem for a long time, and you didn't care about it till it affected you, you know, your community specifically. And I was like, there's kind of a point to that, right? Like, when I hear about all these people taking their money, I was like, you're just now like realizing that this is a problem? Like, it took you getting punched in the face basically to know this, or what did it just take you getting punched in the face for you to care? You know, you didn't care when, I'm not saying you specifically, but certain donors apparently, you know, they didn't care so much when Roland Fryer got pushed out of Harvard, in my mind, unfairly. But now they're up in arms because Claudine Gay basically said what I believe most university presidents would say had they been brought to Capitol Hill. And I think her comments were egregious. However, you know, people came after her with the torches, right? But where were you when XYZ thing happened in terms of some progressive woke malfeasance happening on campus? So what is your response to people who make that claim? Is it just we had to learn the hard way, or is there more to it?
Well, I mean, there were certainly people, you know, people in my community that have been trying to draw attention to campus anti-Semitism and, you know, the anti-Semitism that's endemic to DEI and affirmative action for, you know, well over a decade now.
Yeah. Yeah. We love you, David Bernstein.
But in terms of, exactly, but in terms of, you know, Jewish donors, you know, this relates to the nonprofit that I'm a fellow at, the Jewish Leadership Project, which was founded to put pressure on Jewish Jewish organizations and Jewish leaders, legacy organizations and leaders, the mainstream organizations, ADL, the Jewish Federations, the JCRCs, Hillel, to actually prioritize keeping Jews safe and fighting anti-Semitism, because they have not been doing their job. If they had, then we wouldn't be at the state we're at today, especially on college campuses. And I think that the question of why Jewish leaders have not really done much until now is a multifactorial question and answer. There are many reasons, one being that many of these Jews are liberal themselves. So they are ideologically conflicted and they had blinders on when they saw anti-Semitism coming from the left, right? They didn't want to believe it. You know, people might not understand why Jews have kind of traditionally, at least in America, been liberal. But I think it makes sense if you, you know, understand the backlash from the far right fascism of Nazi Germany. It makes sense that Jews would then go in a more left-leaning direction. Also, if you, you know, if we're trying to ally with other, you know, minority groups, you know, being liberal is that's seen as like, you know, at least in the mainstream media, the more compassionate political side to be on. And also, like I said, originally, you know, Judaism, you know, relative to Christianity or Islam has been kind of a more liberal religion, right? I mean, you know, the Talmud is just filled, you know, with interpretations and questions, right? And questions have always been very, very much encouraged in the tradition of Judaism, as well as reflections, right? And so I think it's kind of in Jewish DNA and our nature to kind of be like, well, what did we do to precipitate, you know, what's happening with us right now? There's a lot of, you know, kind of Jewish self that, you know, we hear the term self-hating Jews. This is where this comes from. There's books written about this phenomenon, right? Where Jews kind of blame themselves for any sort of wrong that's done to us. And many Jews themselves end up being anti-Semitic, one of whom Candace Owens had on her show, Norman Finkelstein, who's a notorious Holocaust denier. But so that's one reason. Jewish leaders have been ideologically conflicted. They're also conflict averse, right? I mean, they've achieved a certain status in society and a certain acceptance, right? In the mainstream, ADL is the go-to organization for every single mainstream media outlet, right? And they don't want to, you know, they don't want to step out of any sort of orthodox, you know, narrative. And the idea of left-wing anti-Semitism is, unfortunately, it's not popular, and it can be risky to draw attention to that. And so I think a lot of Jewish leaders were, if they did see what was going on and they didn't have blinders on, I think they were afraid yeah. to speak out about it. And I think there's other reasons as well, but I think those are a few of them.
And I think, honestly, if people look at themselves, honestly, a lot of folks were afraid to speak out about a lot of different things. And so, I mean, we saw that a lot. I saw it personally a lot during the pandemic. You know, people who behind closed doors would say, I don't like this, or I don't agree with the way things are going. I don't agree with this lockdown. I don't agree with mandates, but then they don't say anything. But then they just get in line and they get the shot, even though they're against it or whatever. Same thing with fighting the gender stuff, right? Like, so many people will whisper to me, like,
right,
I'm a liberal, but I think this stuff is nuts.
Exactly.
And then they won't say anything.
Yeah, and David Bernstein, who we've had on the show, has more experience with this in terms of, you know, the Jewish world than anybody else, you know? I mean, how many people did he encounter? You know, he was part of this kind of like legacy world of Jewish organizations. And there were so many people he encountered that felt the same way he did, but they were too scared to speak up.
Yeah.
You know, they had to just drum the same beat of white supremacy, white supremacy, white supremacy. You know, they didn't want to draw attention. I mean, and God forbid, you know, anyone, Jew or not, draw attention to anti-Semitism coming from a minority community,
yeah.
Right? I mean, that's just like completely off limits. And that's one of the things that's allowed anti-Semitism to thrive, right? Because in places like Los Angeles or New York especially, the majority of the incidents, the anti-Semitic incidents against Jews have been coming from the Black and the Hispanic communities. But that is not an okay thing to report on, because under the, you know, intersectional, you know, hierarchy of oppression and the anti-racist worldview, you know, minorities cannot be racist. They can't even be responsible for their actions. I mean, it's incredibly infantilizing and racist in itself, right? To deny, you know, marginalized communities their own agency. But so this really breeds more anti-Semitism, especially as Jews fall on, you know, the side of the oppressor in this left-wing intersectional hierarchy, which is just so bizarre when you think about the fact that, you know, Jews are you know, they're the largest victim of religious hate crimes, but per capita, they're actually the largest victim of hate crimes of any group in America. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jews are actually per capita twice as likely to be targeted as a Black person. The idea that we would be, you know, put into the oppressor class, and why are we lumped into that category? Because according to the left, we are considered white, and mm-hmm. whiteness is automatically placed into that category of privileged and powerful. But, you know, I mean, how bitterly ironic when you think about the fact that 6 million Jews were slaughtered, you know, less than 100 years ago for the very fact that we were not white, that we were not considered white, that we were not considered Aryan, right? Mm-hmm. It would also be quite surprising for the more than 50% of Jews in Israel who are, you know, who have Middle Eastern roots, who are from the Middle East or North Africa and are indistinguishable aesthetically from their Arab brothers and sisters, to find out that they are all considered white now in America.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. It's upside down. And it really breeds, it's just a perfect recipe for increased hatred against Jews. And that's really what David Bernstein dives into in his book, Woke Antisemitism, is precisely that type of format. And, you know, and it ends up uniting a lot of people on the left and the right. I mean, it's, you know, the political spectrum, it's not really, I don't really look at it as like a straight line. I look at it more as like a horseshoe, right? And you get like further enough to the right or the left, and then you kind of like meet, right? You just move back around and you tend in the same direction. And that is really the case for anti-Semites. I mean, there's a reason why David Duke is a big fan of Ilhan Omar, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why, you know, this term Jewish supremacy, which was coined by David Duke, I believe he wrote a book called Jewish Supremacy, is now taken up by the far left, right? And they refer to Israel as a Jewish supremacist state. And a lot of, you know, a lot of these woke Black leaders like of BLM or of the Women's March, like Tamika Mallory, they'll use these terms like Jewish supremacists. And these are neo-Nazi terms. And you know, there's also, I mean, look at the BDS movement. Yeah, it's a left-wing movement, but it's also heavily supported by the far right. But, you know, it's they have the same goal. They're united. They're united in their hatred of either the individual Jew in the case of the far right, or the collective Jew in the case of the far left, which is the state of Israel. Because anti-Semitism is a really fascinating and complicated form of hatred that morphs through the ages. They say it's the longest hatred, right? And and it kind of adapts to fit the changing needs of a society at any given time. So, you know, Jews, you know, were originally we want to go back to biblical history. That's even a whole other story. But, you know, during the time of Christ, we were seen as the killers, right, of Christ, and Jews were hated for their religion. And then once, you know, the Enlightenment happened and scientific values became, you know, the main go-to in society, Jews were then, it was decided that Jews were then a race, and we were hated for our race, right? And the Holocaust, Hitler called us a race, and we were an inferior race. And now we're hated for our nation state, because now, you know, human rights is a value that is so prevalent among societies. And so Israel now becomes the ultimate human rights abuser, right? The evil, you know, the sole state that is not deserving of any other, you know, any of the other rights that other nations are afforded. They're not allowed to defend themselves. They're not allowed to exist in peace and harmony. They must be eradicated. And, you know, half of all of the world's Jews essentially live in Israel. So for people who say things like, I'm just anti-Zionist, I'm not anti-Semitic, well, if you're anti-Zionist, then you don't support the national, what Zionism is, which is the national liberation movement in the indigenous homeland of in Israel. And if you don't support the national liberation movement, then you don't support a Jewish state. And if you don't support a Jewish state, then where do you expect those 9 million Jews to go? right? I mean, it's not like they're going to be safe in an Arab state. Like close to 1 million Jews were kicked out of Middle Eastern nations in the 40s and 50s, dispossessed of their property with nowhere to go. But they were absorbed and taken in mostly by Israel. Many of them went to France as well, but largely they came to Israel and they were taken in as refugees, even though Israel was broke and they really didn't have the resources to do so. So, you know, Jews, you know, contrary to this very, very revisionist historical belief that Jews and Muslims lived in harmony before the state of Israel, quite the contrary. Jews were largely, same with Christians, were largely relegated to second-class citizens. They were known as what's called dhimmis, and you know they knew the rules, but they lived, you know, they were not free living in these Arab societies, and nor would they be in any sort of future Arab state that replaces Israel.
Yeah, and I don't think people understand how frequently and consistently Israel has to be home base for Jews that are facing persecution. Or like, this isn't just, oh, all the Jews from the Holocaust, and now the Holocaust was a long time ago, everything's great, you know,
right,
we're over that. It's like, no, there's Jews that are persecuted in Ethiopia. Like this happens all over the place, mm-hmm. and it's consistent, and there are regularly operations that Israel executes to go get her people,
yeah,
from around the, it didn't end with the Holocaust, right? Like,
right,
not at all. Yeah, I mean, that was a huge deal, obviously the biggest incident, but it's mm-hmm. ongoing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the changes I've seen in my Jewish peers since October 7th is they realize just how important Israel is, as they've seen the response to October 7th, as they've seen people celebrating it. They've seen a lot of Jew haters and anti-Zionists come out of the closet. You know, I've heard more than one person say, it's so ironic that there was just the biggest massacre in Israel's history, and yet I feel like I believe I would feel more safe in Israel right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Sad too.
Because there's something just being amongst your people.
That's a beautiful thing. I'm saying it's sad that people feel so unsafe in other places where they used to feel safe.
Right. But it speaks to something because I think that safety is not just physical safety, right? It's also feeling safe to express one's identity, feeling safe to, you know, be your, you know, celebrate your own culturehood and practice your own traditions and things like that. And at the end of the day, like, you know, there's no 100% guarantee of that except for in Israel.
Yep. Okay. I think that's a good period on it. We will do our 10 quick fire questions and then okay. anything that you want to add after the fact. And actually, your final thoughts, I would love for you to include in your final thoughts something that you're feeling hopeful about and, you know, something like very positive that you're seeing, since mm-hmm. we hit some heavy, there's been some heaviness to this episode, I feel like. So I'd love to end on a happy note too.
Sure.
If you can, if you're willing to. So, okay. Are you ready for your quick fire questions? 10 fun questions. There's no right or wrong answer. It's just so people can see another side of you.
Sure, sure. And are these questions like, are they like yes or no? Like, should I just answer them very briefly?
You can answer them however you want. The goal is for it to be fast, but let's be honest. At least half my guests don't do it fast. So, all right. Question number one, Jordan or LeBron?
Wayne Gretzky.
Number two, what is your favorite movie with a black lead?
The first one that comes to mind is Blade.
Yeah. What's the biggest misconception
Blade
about?
Blade 2. I liked Blade 2 better.
Okay. That's a good, we should have a debate about that, Blade 1 or Blade 2. What's the biggest misconception about you?
Do you have a few hours? No. oh, man. I don't know. There's so many. I don't really know. I don't know. A lot of people think I'm really intense, but I think I'm actually kind of chill.
Should the United States return to the gold standard?
I know people who would definitely say yes. I don't, my instinct would be no, but I don't feel 100, 100% qualified to have an opinion on that.
What is the tastiest style of cheese?
Oh, my parents used to have, I grew up in, my parents had a creamery. We had a cheese store.
Oh, wow.
I really like Camembert. I like all gourmet cheeses. So I don't think I can pick one above the rest, but I will say the cheese that I do not like is blue cheese, but only if it's the crappy kind of blue cheese. If it's the really gourmet blue cheese, that's still okay. But like the regular blue cheese that everybody just normally buys at the supermarket and puts on their sandwich, I don't like that at all. Mm. Any other cheese is fine, and the stinkier the better.
Okay. Does pineapple go on pizza?
I don't mind pineapple on pizza. I'm okay with it.
That's my girl. Okay. What is your favorite board game?
Ooh, I love board games. I grew up with Sorry. I think that's a great one.
What are your thoughts on white people having dreadlocks?
I think if they want to have dreadlocks, they should go and have dreadlocks. In Israel, you see a lot of people with dreadlocks, and I don't think they realize how dated they look.
Are the best things in life really free?
Yes.
And should Pluto still be considered a planet?
I don't know anything about that. Didn't they say it was? Is there actually debate about this? I thought they just decided it wasn't a planet and that everybody was like, okay, are there still people that are like, no, it is a planet?
There's people who are passionate Plutoers. Yeah. We've had a few on the podcast. Yeah.
No way. Okay. Yeah. No, I have no idea. And I'd love to learn the arguments for and against.
Okay. That was your 10th question. So you got through them. No problem. Great. Final thoughts. That's what would you fun. Like to leave our audience with?
Well, I just want to thank you so much for having me. As I mentioned, I love what you guys do and the perspectives that you put out there. And, you know, I discovered you through Dr. Lee, who has just been such an inspiration. And, you know, we interviewed her twice on my show, and I feel very grateful to have met her and worked with her. And, you know, despite the heaviness of this podcast episode, I would say we were talking a little earlier, and I mentioned that, you know, a silver lining to all of this is the fact that I think for the first time, at least I'm witnessing these issues of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism come to the forefront. And for those of us who've kind of been screaming about it for decades and, you know, begging for it to be brought into the mainstream conversation, you know, now I'm hearing people who are not Jewish and don't really have a stake in this actually talking about it and being disturbed by how normalized this hatred has become. So I'm grateful to that, and you know, hopefully that will lead to some real change in the future.
I have that same hope. Thank you, Karis Rea. Thank you for joining us, and I'm sure our paths will cross again, because obviously, like you just said, you just had Dr. Lee on a couple times, and we consider you to be an ally and a friend. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Connie. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. The number you have dialed.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.